Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are The Seagull and Bernard and Huey. The book is Tough Ain't Enough. That's a good tease. Hi, David. How are you?
Okay, Joe. How are you doing this week?
Moving on.
Okay, don't answer.
All right.
That's all right. Your secrets are safe with me. Okay. I would like to talk about a couple of films that are coming out right about now, and also about a book, which we don't usually do, but which I think is fun to do from time to time. And yeah, we'll just let that title hang as a sort of a tease, as you very appropriately put it. And then we'll get to that in a few minutes. So let us start off with The Seagull. Those of us who are culture vultures will know that The Seagull is the title of a play by Anton Chekhov, and this is a movie based very closely on that play. I say based on it closely rather than a movie of the play, because first of all, it's certainly not done on a stage. That's actually one of the best things about it, is quite beautiful settings and places where it is and so forth. It's a beautiful sort of a lot of exteriors and luxurious interiors, but also it's really condensed. The movie's a little over an hour and a half long, and the play is considerably longer than that. So the movie inevitably has been criticized on that ground for leaving a whole lot out, and of course it actually does. But I think the movie, which certainly is not a classic film in the way that The Seagull is a genuinely classic play, it's truly one of the major Chekhov plays. I suppose all of his plays are one by one measure or another major, but this one is very major. It's a major, major one. The movie is not on that level, and it has its flaws, but I found it really quite watchable. So the basic, and also, by the way, it has a wonderful cast. So the basic storyline of it is that most of it takes place on a country estate where an aging actress spends her summers with her brother and her son, and now she is bringing along her lover, who is a very famous novelist, and unfortunately her son aspires to be a great writer as well, and her husband, who is a really old guy and is sort of on his last legs, always dreamed of being a writer and never managed to get to the first base with it. There are also other characters, but that's sort of basically going on. And the other really crucial figure is a young woman named Nina, who lives nearby, and she falls in love with Boris, who is the lover and the famous novelist and all of that. And he seems to be a very nice man, but at one point he conceives the idea for a work of fiction in which a man visits some people on their country estate and doesn't have anything to do particularly. So to pass the time, he seduces and destroys a young woman. And he sort of does exactly that. And not all of this is part of the actual action of it. We find out some of it sort of after the case. But it's a very, very dramatic story, and in some ways a very melodramatic story. But it's a pretty engrossing story. And if you've sort of touched bases with The Seagull over the years, it's always sort of like visiting an old friend. The cast, as I said, is really, really good. And so we have Annette Bening as the actress who owns the estate and spends her summers there. We have Elizabeth Moss as Masha, the extremely unhappy young woman who spends, an extremely happy young woman, there's more than one in the movie, that delivers very early in the play and the film one of the always, for me, most memorable Chekhov lines. Somebody asks her why she always wears black, and she says, "I'm in mourning for my life." We have Saoirse Ronan, who plays the young woman from the neighboring estate who falls in love with a famous novelist and is ultimately kind of destroyed by this. We have Corey Stoll, who is such a fine actor, as that novelist Boris Trigorin, as the old on his last legs husband Brian Dennehy, and there's more people, including Mare Winningham, who I met many years ago and told me her name actually is Mare, not Mary. She's in it too as one of the servants. And so it's a very, very nicely done movie. My main complaint about it, aside from the fact that it really does condense more than it probably absolutely has to, the play, yeah, it cuts about more out of it than it probably really should. It's a bit heavy on the suffering. Now, there's a lot of suffering in Chekhov, and there's a lot of suffering in The Seagull. A lot of people who are very unhappy, and sometimes they express that unhappiness very openly. But precisely because there's so much of it, a really first-rate production of pretty much any Chekhov play, and certainly this one, has to sort of touch on these things without pushing them into our faces. And here there's just a bit too much of the in-your-face suffering. There is just a bit too much of the tear-filled eyes filling the entire screen and that sort of thing. And I found that a flaw of the movie. But by and large, the film, which was directed by Michael Mayer and adapted by the writer Stephen Karam, it's a good movie, and a lot of critics have not liked it very much. I think it's a perfectly adequate thing. And if you have people who don't have time for, you know, a whole 3 hours or so of Chekhov on the stage, you know, this is not a bad sort of Reader's Digest condensed version of the Seagull. It's a great play, and some of its greatness comes through in the movie adaptation. So let us move on to Bernard and Huey. Now we have something which is also kind of literary in a certain sort of a way, but a totally different sort of a way. Here we have a screenplay that was written way back in the middle 1980s by Jules Pfeiffer, the very, very fine and almost sort of, I guess, legendary cartoonist, who did a cartoon strip in the Village Voice in New York way back, starting in the middle 1950s. And way back in the middle 80s, he wrote this screenplay based loosely on his comic strips and on characters who appear in those comic strips, particularly, obviously, Bernard and Huey. And then the screenplay sort of, I guess that Jules put it in a drawer or something because it languished. And just in recent years, a couple of filmmakers decided that they would like to get a hold of the screenplay and maybe make a movie out of it. And apparently it took them a few years to find the screenplay, which had been in a drawer or somewhere for about 30 years. But eventually they did find it, and it is now a movie. Directed by Dan Mirvish, and screenplay once again by Jules Pfeiffer. So the main characters are Bernard Mergenthaler, who was always the name, the sort of Pfeiffer surrogate in his comic strips, and his friend Huey. And we see them in two different phases of their lives. Mainly we see them as sort of middle-aged grumpy men. That's the main sort of the part of the film. And then we also see them when they're very, very young and just out of college and looking forward to what life is going to bring them and thinking about writing something together and what's going to happen. And so, again, that's sort of a frame tale, that younger Bernard and Huey. Most of it takes place when they're sort of middle-aged guys. And as it's happened, Bernard is doing very well, lives in New York. Of course, Pfeiffer is very much a New York artist, a New York writer. Bernard is doing very well. Never quite gotten married successfully, but you know he's doing nicely. He's an editor at a publishing company, not a very glamorous job, but he likes it and all that. And suddenly, who shows up but his old friend Huey? And Huey is a mess. He is just—he's a guy who has never, shall we say, learned the social graces. So things get interesting when Bernard's daughter Zelda, who he hasn't seen in years and years and years, shows up. Also, his ex-wife is on the scene, Bernard's ex-wife is on the scene, and little by little, the much more civilized Bernard gets involved with the uncivilized Huey's daughter, and things go from there. And then she gets herself a boyfriend, and things get even more complicated. So it's a kind of an antic story. It's a very lightweight story. Some of it is a sort of a satire on New York life and New York life the way it was back in the 80s and the way it is now. And it's very lightweight and not particularly memorable. It's very, very nicely acted, though, primarily, I would say, by Jim Rash, who plays Bernard, the more civilized of these two old friends. He looks uncannily. He is, by the way, a writer as well as an actor. And he's not awfully familiar to me as an actor, but he looks uncannily like Jules Pfeiffer. I met Jules Pfeiffer years ago. He looked uncannily like Jules Pfeiffer years ago, which means he also looks kind of like Bernard Mercantile used to look like in the comic strip. And he is really, really good. David Kochner does a nice job opposite him as Huey. And then there's a whole bunch of very fine women in the cast as well, playing people like the wife and the daughter and so forth. So it is certainly not a great film. I don't think it is going to be a major part of Jules Pfeiffer's legacy. He's been involved with the movies before. Years ago, he wrote a novel, and there was a movie called Harry the Rat with Women. But you know, he's been in the movies before. This is, again, it's not going to open up a new chapter in his career. He's really old now, and I'm happy to say he's still very much alive and very much involved with this movie release. But he's a good guy, and I'm glad that he's back on the scene with this old new project of his. And now I would like to touch bases with a book. Again, unusually for us, but I kind of like to do it. We all know that it's very unusual for me to plug one of my books on our weekly show. And it's even more unusual for me to plug a book that I didn't write on our weekly show. I can't remember whether or not I plugged my book on Clint Eastwood, which came out a few years ago. It's not my most recent book, but it's called The Cinema of Clint Eastwood, Chronicles of America. That is one of my Eastwood projects. This is a book, Tough Ain't Enough, about Clint Eastwood. But it's not a book written by anybody. It's an edited collection. It was edited by David Desser, a very respected colleague of mine, and Lester D. Friedman, a respected colleague and very, very good friend of mine. The full title of the book is Tough Ain't Enough, New Perspectives on the Films of Clint Eastwood. There is always plenty of stuff to say about Clint, and this book brings together some of the most recent things that have been said. Now, my own chapter in this book is about Clint Eastwood's biopics, those biographical movies that he made, that he has made over the years, going back to fairly early in his career, that deal with real people and that are based in whole or in part on the lives of real people. So what I still think to this day is Clint Eastwood's greatest movie ever, Bird, from 1988, is a regular biopic of the jazz saxophone legend Charlie Parker. He also made a pretty good documentary back in 2011 of J. Edgar Hoover called J. Edgar. And then he's made some movies which are kind of unconventional biopics, or you might say kind of quasi biopics or semi biopics. There's Jersey Boys, for example, which I consider to be a kind of a biopic, and it's about the Four Seasons and about their rise to fame, the rock group. American Sniper, one of his more recent films, deals with a sniper working for the American forces in Iraq. I think it's a pretty appalling movie, and I think it's one of Clint's worst and most morally reprehensible, but that's another story, and I get into that. Also, his very recent film, Sully, about the guy who landed a plane in the Hudson River, is a biopic. And then other movies like White Hunter, Black Heart, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Invictus, these are all biopics of a sort, partial, semi, quasi-biopics. And then his very fine two-part series of films about World War II, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. So he's made a whole lot of movies which are or are sort of like biopics. So I want to point out this book because, again, Clint Eastwood is a figure of kind of never-ending interest. And as I've just indicated, I certainly don't regard everything he's done in his career as particularly admirable. I think he's made some absolutely marvelous movies. I'll mention Bird again. That's an excellent example. And he has made some pretty reprehensible movies. I already mentioned one, and one might even, certainly might bring Dirty Harry into that category. And when he tried to sort of make up for the morally reprehensible parts of Dirty Harry by making a movie called Gran Torino a few years ago, it turned out to be one of his worst movies. So you can never know how these things are go. Chapters in this book were written by all, or I should say essays, which is what I prefer to call them, are written by all kinds of really excellent scholars, almost all of whom I know very well. Stephen Prince wrote an essay called I Don't Want Nobody Belonging to Me, Riding the Post-Leone Western. Diane Carson wrote one called I'm Not So Tough, Melodrama and Performance in the Later Films. Jonathan Kirshner, with whom I've been working recently on another project, wrote one called A Man's Got to Know His Limitations, the cop films from Nixon through Reagan. David Desser wrote one called I Know I'm As Blind as a Slab of Concrete, But I'm Not Helpless, about Eastwood and the aging action hero. And Alexandra Keller, who I know from my graduate school years, wrote one about race in Eastwood's films, the title of which is Seems Like We Can't Trust the White Man. So those are only some of the essays in the book. It's a very, very intriguing book. It's coming out right about now. And again, Clint Eastwood, whether you admire him or whether you despise him or however you feel, he's a really hugely important force in American culture as a star, as a movie director and auteur, as an icon. And I think that we can always understand these people. It's always important to understand them as well as we can, because whether we adore them or despise them, they have a lot of influence, at least indirectly, on our culture. And so that is my somewhat hodgy-podgy story this week, Jill.